It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a look at poverty in Wisconsin and how things have changed since the Great Recession.
First, from a highly anticipated decision on the Paris Climate Agreement to the resignation of a top communication official, there's a lot of news coming out of the White House this week.
And Congress is figuring out how to tackle some key funding bills before a deadline this autumn.
Scott Wong joins us now to talk about those stories and more in our weekly look at national news. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he covers House Republicans and Paul Ryan. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So since this trip by President Trump, visiting a bunch of nations, including some allies in Europe, President Trump is expected to announce his decision on whether or not to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. What's the latest? What do we know about when and if he's going to do something?
Well, we saw some early reports this morning that White House sources said Trump would soon pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. That would fulfill a major campaign promise from 2016, but of course it's sounding alarm bells for some of our allies around the world who obviously, you know, consider global warming one of the biggest threats to the environment and to the world. You know, at home, Democrats are outraged. They say Trump's decision signals that we're taking a step back from being a leader in this world. Nancy Pelosi called it an abdication of American leadership. And Donald Trump's even receiving some criticism from within his own party. Three Florida Republican congressmen and women, obviously coming from Florida, whose states and coastlines are deeply impacted by climate change, are slamming this decision. Donald Trump is saying on Twitter, hold on a minute, you know, I haven't made any decisions yet. Something will come out later this week, and, you know, no final decision has been made. So I think there are many people who are still trying to lobby him on this major decision. They feel like in the past, Donald Trump has proven he's changed his mind at the last minute, as he did with his threats to pull out of the NAFTA agreement. And they're hoping that maybe he has a change of heart with the Paris Climate Agreement as well.
And at the same time, what was it, some 20 Senate Republicans wrote him a note saying, no, no, go ahead, pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Don't change your mind at this point. So he's getting, and then there's talk that there are differences on his own team as well. So he's getting a lot of different messages on this.
Right, and I think the important thing to remember with Donald Trump is, you know, no decision is final until it actually happens. He is somebody who, you know, sort of decides these things based on a feeling. He talks to a lot of people, you know, gets input from a range of sources inside and outside the White House on Capitol Hill. You know, I think the reaction that's making the biggest waves maybe today is from Tesla creator Elon Musk, who serves on the White House Economic and Manufacturing Councils for Donald Trump. He's threatened to resign from those positions if the United States leaves the climate accord. That's causing some bad headlines for the president today.
And one headline that came out was that one source said the president is going to announce he's going to pull out, but leave some wiggle room that he could be back in or be some part of the agreement even after announcing that he's out. So even that decision, if it comes in the next couple of days, might have a loophole in it?
Well, that's what we're hearing. Again, these are mostly based on anonymous sources, and so we don't know what the final decision will be. Of course, as you mentioned, he does have a number of Republican senators and House members lobbying him to pull out of this agreement because they see this really as an anti-business type of accord and really something that is a remnant of Obama-era regulations and policies left behind from 8 years of President Obama.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the biggest stories in national politics over the last week. Scott, Mike Dubke, not a household name, I think, communications director, or now former communications director at the White House. He left that position after just a few months. What do we make of that decision?
Well, as you mentioned, not really a household name. In fact, I had never heard of him before he was appointed just a few months ago. He actually turned in his resignation on May 18th, but the news is just leaking out this week. He's a veteran media strategist who was very close to Karl Rove, very much a behind-the-scenes type of guy. He was not part of the Trump campaign. He was really more of an establishment Republican guy. And he found it very hard to fit in with the Trump inner circle. He did not have a previous relationship with the president. And as we know from watching the president over these last couple years, the president values long-standing relationships and values loyalty. People are interpreting this departure as sort of the first step in what might be a major shakeup in the White House front office. People are watching closely to see what happens with Press Secretary Sean Spicer, who is rumored to be, you know, on the outs. Same with Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, also a Wisconsin native and the former RNC chairman. He is also, has been rumored over the past few months, in fact, ever since President Trump took the oath of office, to be somebody who has a target on his back. And so this is all stems from the president's disgruntlement, disappointment with how the news coverage has been going, with so much focus on the Russia investigation, on possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government during the 2016 election. And Trump may be trying to shake things up and try something different to get back on the right track.
Speaking of that Russia investigation, last time we talked to you, that was a big topic. What do we know about the latest in the House and Senate intelligence committees and their investigation here?
Well, they're moving forward, and we may be hearing from James Comey on Capitol Hill as early as next week. The House and the Senate are on recess for Memorial Day this week, and so there's a bit of a break and a bit of a pause. Lawmakers are going back to their districts where they're hearing an earful from constituents on everything from health care to tax reform to the Russia investigation. But things will start to pick up again on this investigation as soon as next week when lawmakers come back into town. So I guess the big question right now is what day James Comey, the ousted FBI director, will appear on Capitol Hill and answer, and what types of things will he say about whether or not the president asked him to halt his investigation into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, about some of the biggest headlines in national politics this week.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think the president should pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement? Why or why not? And do you think the president needs to shake up his communications and other staff? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our regular Week in Washington discussion with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill.
And you can join us by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what you think of some of the new criminal justice laws that the GOP is proposing. Do you support the tough-on-crime direction they're taking? And also, do you have thoughts on President Trump's most recent tweet that has bewildered the internet? What do you think Covfefe is? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Scott, I want to talk to you about some of the regular business before Congress. Congress, as a rule, does things like passes funding and appropriation bills. You wrote a piece on that, a lot on the hopper now. Big question over when and how to do this. What's going on?
Well, there's a number of senior House appropriators. These are the people that sort of control the purse strings on Capitol Hill that are urging Republican leadership to, quote, go ugly early. They want Republican leaders to pass a massive government funding bill for the upcoming fiscal year, 2018, before the August recess rather than wait to the last minute and risk a government shutdown in the fall. And so typically what happens or what's happened in recent years is lawmakers wait until the last minute deadline, and they're facing a shutdown, they're facing a crisis, and then they strike a last minute deal. Well, some Republicans, including Tom Graves, he's an appropriator from Georgia, are pleading with their colleagues to let's try to get started a little bit earlier on this process. We know that there's not time enough to do regular order and pass, you know, the 12 total appropriation bills one by one. So let's package them all into an omnibus plan and tackle that this summer before Congress adjourns for 1 month in August and takes their annual summer recess. That plan is going to be challenging, to say the least, because of the short time frame, but it is getting a pretty good reception from some fellow appropriators and even some members of leadership.
And this is something where, okay, if the House came together on this and did it, well, there's still the Senate, and there's still not a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, so Democrats would have to theoretically be brought on board. So is there thoughts that, well, okay, we're going to start negotiating bipartisan right off the bat?
Well, that is one, that is another tactic that is being looked at, especially from some of the moderate Republicans like Charlie Dent, another appropriator who hails from the more centrist Tuesday group. He says, let's just right off the bat start negotiating with Democrats and avoid a shutdown this fall. The more conservative approach by Tom Graves from Georgia is that let's pass a Republican-only bill and have this big fight in July before we leave for break, and then we can spend the month of August actually messaging it and talking about our priorities and why we took these stands, and then we'll go ahead after the break. So a lot of people actually believe this is going to put Capitol Hill and lawmakers in the exact same position if they had waited to the last minute anyways. And many are already anticipating another continuing resolution to keep the government's lights on come September 30th. So, you know, Capitol Hill likes to sort of govern by crisis. It's been the norm for the past 5 years or so. And a lot of people are still skeptical that, you know, Republicans will be able to get this job done earlier than expected.
And then we've got the budget outline from the White House. Does that enter into this discussion? Is this an opportunity in these appropriations votes to start trying to put some of those priorities into practice, or is that a whole different issue?
No, certainly Trump has laid out his budget priorities. It involves more spending on the military side, more severe cuts on the non-defense side, and of course things like money for a border wall, which is a huge controversy in itself. I think Republicans and those who control the purse strings on Capitol Hill, they are trying to write their own budget. The appropriators are trying to work through their own issues. They will take and incorporate a little bit of what Trump has proposed, but also put forth you know, their own priorities. And that's typically how it works, is even if they are part of the same party, in this case Republicans control the White House and Congress, Republicans on Capitol Hill will not simply adopt what the president proposes. They will make tweaks here and there and try to make it more of their own and try to pass their own priorities.
Talking about some of the top stories out of national politics, Scott Wong is with us from The Hill. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. We're about to get into minimum sentencing laws, maybe making a comeback, both from the White House and in Congress. So what do you think about that? Should we be looking to lower the number of people in prison or go back to more mandatory minimum sentences? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Scott, let's get into that. There's been a movement on criminal justice, including a lot of Republicans and conservative funders saying, hey, we've got too many people in prison. We need to get rid of mandatory minimums, look for alternatives. Some different ideas now coming out of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and now something new in Congress along these lines. What are we seeing there?
Well, that's right. Over the past few years, you have seen a push from some key Republicans, including Paul Ryan and Rand Paul, Mike Lee, with help from the conservative Koch brothers, to try to pass criminal justice reform to actually reduce prison sentences. They feel like it's just a strain, an economic strain on states and local governments and the federal government, as well as it's you know, just too many people. Millions of people are stuck behind bars, and specifically they had concerns about people who were convicted of minor drug offenses and other nonviolent crimes. Well, there's a new push, in probably spurred by President Trump and some of his anti-immigration rhetoric, and coupled with the new Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who is another immigration hardliner, a former senator who really made his reputation as an anti-immigrant crusader. Now there's some new push on Capitol Hill, looking at mandatory 5-year minimum prison sentences for undocumented immigrants, who folks with a criminal record who try to enter the country after being deported. Specifically, this is focused on something called Kate's Law, which was named for a woman, Kate Steinle, who was fatally shot in San Francisco by an undocumented immigrant from Mexico. This individual had been deported 5 times and convicted of multiple felonies, and still managed to work his way back into the country and then commit murder. So this has been a priority of not only President Trump, but of Republicans on Capitol Hill. And so we're starting to hear a little bit more about it. Some key individuals are involved. John Cornyn, the number two Republican leader in the Senate, as well as Homeland Security Chairman Mike McCaul from Texas. They are involved right now in drafting some new border security legislation that would include Kate's Law.
What's been the response from prison reform folks? Are they worried that this pushes things in the other direction, or is this such a narrowly defined subset of criminal offenders that it wouldn't make that big of a difference to them?
Well, I think some Democrats have tried to point out to John Cornyn, look, you've been in this Paul Ryan camp before of trying to enact criminal justice reform to really reduce some of the prison sentences for minor offenders. Aren't you being hypocritical in pushing, stiffer mandatory sentences when it comes to undocumented immigrants? And he says, no, it's really a case-by-case basis. Generally, he is for lowering prison sentences, but in specific cases when you're dealing with violent crimes or very serious crimes, like Kate's Law, like this incident involving Kate's Law, then there's a reason to have stiffer punishments. The other aspect of this is, of course, people who commit violent crimes against judges and police officers. There are much stiffer penalties being proposed by John Cornyn and Mike McCaul under this legislation. That comes in the wake of some violent attacks on police officers across the country, including in John Cornyn's home state of Texas.
I want to touch on a couple more stories before we run out of time, Scott. Last week we saw a 2016 recording of Congressman Kevin McCarthy joking with other Republicans about Russia paying off President Trump. Now, this recording of this private meeting was leaked to the public. Paul Ryan in that says, hey, let's not leak this, guys. Keep it in the family, basically. I'm paraphrasing there.
Right.
There's been some political fallout. What do we know about what they're trying to find out about how that got recorded and released?
Well, I broke a story that basically said Speaker Ryan and his GOP leadership team have launched now an internal review of how this happened, how this individual last year secretly recorded a very private leadership meeting. This was a leadership meeting that happened behind closed doors in the Speaker's office. A very limited number of people were in that room, and then managed to leak the audio to the Washington Post. Basically, they are looking at whether there are any D.C. or federal statutes that were violated or any sort of internal House rules that were broken by doing this. The leadership team suspects the leaker is Evan McMullen. They have a name. Although there's no direct evidence that he is the one who leaked this information, he was serving as a leadership aide at the time and was actually in that meeting. He later, of course, ran for president as an independent against Donald Trump, and so and has been a very outspoken critic of Donald Trump. And so he had certainly a motivation to leak it and to try to embarrass Donald Trump and some of his Republican allies on Capitol Hill. But again, there's no direct evidence that he is the one who did this.
I want to wrap up looking at a presidential tweet. So this one, less shocking than the internet found it pretty amusing. What did we see come out? I think it was just after midnight last night.
Right. You might have missed this story because it happened so quickly and was deleted so fast. But Trump tweeted, quote, last night, just after midnight, despite the constant negative press, COFEFE, COVEFEFE, and it sort of set the internet ablaze and the Twitter sphere sort of went wild with speculation about what the president was trying to say and how you pronounce this Trump-invented word. By the morning, the tweet was gone, but Trump managed to poke fun at himself, asking his followers if they could guess the meaning of this sort of made-up word, COFEFE. Go ahead.
Sean Spicer said at a press conference this afternoon, he said the president and a small group of people knew what he meant. I don't know if he was playing along with the joke or if there is some kind of secret meaning. Briefly, Scott, what's your bet?
I have no idea, and I don't think I'm going to spend any more time thinking about this new Trump made-up word.
Well, happy COFEFE to you, Scott. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, where he covers mainly House Republicans. Join us for a weekly look at national politics.
The new Wisconsin Poverty Report found a decrease in overall statewide poverty between the years of 2014 and 2015. According to the report released by the Institute for Research on Poverty, Milwaukee and La Crosse counties have the biggest challenges, but the report mostly found positive changes, including an addition of 70,000 jobs statewide.
We'd like to hear from you. How did the Great Recession affect your life? Were you able to recover from it? If so, how has that been going so far? What financial obstacles are out there for you in your community, too? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page and find this new report on poverty here in the state.
Tim Smeeting joins us now. He's one of the authors of the new report. He's a distinguished professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Tim, what does this new report tell us about the overall state of poverty and financial security in Wisconsin?
Well, poverty and financial security are two different things, but I can at least talk about what's going on in terms of poverty. When we look at a Wisconsin poverty measure for 2015, which is the most recent year available, we find that finally, 7 years into recovery, the economy is leading the way and helping push down poverty because of an improved labor market. This isn't helping everyone everywhere, but for the first time, it's helping us do better in terms of the way we should be moving people from poverty. That's a stable, secure job that pays a good wage. Not all those jobs are paying good wages. We still need the benefits that we have from the Earned Income Credit and the SNAP program, our food share program, to help supplement those with low earnings. But the economy is finally helping.
And how do poverty rates for children and for families with children look?
That looks even better, to be quite honest. Not quite. The poverty rate for children is 10%, but that's 5 percentage points below the official measure of poverty for the state's children. And here the reason is not only are parents doing better in the labor market, but the food share program and the refundable tax programs, particularly the EITC and the child tax credits, all increase when family size increases, and pay more the more children you have to support, which is what they should be doing. And so these programs make a much more powerful and important package for children.
And you mentioned that the labor market, it seems to be a big part of what's propelling this downward trend in poverty. Can you lay that out a little for us? How does that play into it?
A little more careful about that. The report says Wisconsin gained 70,000 jobs, and that's from the period January 2014 until November 2015, so over 2 years. And the biggest year annually in terms of annual gains was 2014, and then 2015 was another good year. But now we're going into next year, and things aren't looking quite so good, because when we do the report next year, in calendar year 2016, we only gained about 10,000 jobs in Wisconsin. So the kick of the job market is starting to peter out a little bit, perhaps. But the period of 2014 through 2015 that we cover in this report was a good period. There were more jobs. They weren't all wonderfully high-paying jobs, but there were more jobs. And that helped the labor market for the first time since the Great Recession have a significant effect in terms of reducing poverty in Wisconsin.
And right now we are talking with Tim Smeeting, Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, talking about a new report on poverty covering the years 2014 to 2015. And overall trend, positive, Tim, but there are some exceptions. What are those?
Well, the biggest exception and the one that's most disturbing is Central City, Milwaukee. If you look, the whole county of Milwaukee has a poverty rate that's significantly above the state rate. In other words, 9.7 for the state, and Wisconsin is up, I believe, 16%. And inside Milwaukee County, we have six different areas that we can look at because it's, you know, it's quite populous. So the sample's big enough to look at six areas. And in Central City, Milwaukee, the Wisconsin poverty rate is over 30%. And it's under 10 in other areas within the same county. And it's under 9, in fact, 7 or under, in the surrounding counties to the west and the north. So Washington, Ozaukee, Waukesha, even Jefferson, Dodge, and Sheboygan all have poverty rates that are in the single digits, which is a great accomplishment. But right in the middle of Milwaukee, poverty rates are extremely high.
And this is a big gap you're talking about between these high rates in the center of Milwaukee and the surrounding counties and even some of those subsections of the county. Mm-hmm. What do we know about what's happening there?
Well, part of it is that we're looking at an area that's the heart of the black community in Wisconsin. There's more single parenthood. There are more men who have been formerly incarcerated and are having a really hard time finding a job. There are fewer jobs in this particular part of Milwaukee for them to take. So they need transportation out and they need help to get jobs. In fact, one of the things that I applaud the state for doing, I don't applaud everything that they're doing, but in a Wisconsin State Journal op-ed on this past Sunday, I talked about it, is that they're trying to help young first-time offenders in particular when they're released from prison to find a job, reconnect with their families, and stay out of prison. In other words, don't resit for another term. That's very cost-effective for everybody, and we really need that help. But part of the problem is there just aren't that many jobs there in that central part of Milwaukee. So we need to get people out to where there are jobs or find ways to bring jobs closer in for them. And we're not doing a very good job. Milwaukee County lost population and jobs last year. And the area, you know, certain parts of the area aren't doing very well at all, despite the fact that the suburbs are doing well. So that's our biggest poverty problem in the state of Wisconsin.
Was there any upward or downward motion during the year you looked at, or has it been pretty static?
upward or downward motions in terms of...
In Milwaukee, in the area with the highest rate of poverty.
It's been high for a long time. Child poverty is even worse than... the differences in child poverty go from 50% in the middle to under 5% up in Whitefish Bay and Cedarburg, up in the northeast part of the county. So child poverty there has always been a problem. The schools aren't very good there. Not a lot of mothers with good jobs there. The most incarcerated zip code in America is in Central City, Milwaukee. It's just not a good situation, and it's going to need, lots of different actions and some really active policy and especially some leadership in order to really chip away at this problem and make it go away.
Tim Smeeting is with us right now, and he's with the UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs talking about the latest poverty report from there.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about poverty here in Wisconsin? How is it affecting your community? How has your local economy done since the Great Recession? How has your household economy done since the Great Recession? This recovery going on, more jobs. Are you feeling the difference? Are you seeing the difference? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your calls and continue in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation with Tim Smeeting, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, talking about the latest Wisconsin poverty report.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about poverty trends, long and short term here in Wisconsin? Do you have observations? What are you seeing in your community when it comes to the local economy? How about your personal economy? There's been this gradual recovery from the Great Recession. Do you see it? Have you seen it affecting you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's take a caller now. We've got Fred joining us in Eau Claire. Fred, hi.
Hello there.
What do you want to share?
Oh, I just wanted to ask your post there whether or not the trend in Wisconsin is directly related to that of the nation or if there's some differences.
All right, Fred, thank you for that. And Tim, how does that align?
Thanks for that question, Fred. It's a good one. We're all moving in the right direction right now. The nation is recovering even faster and stronger than is Wisconsin. But in every state and in every part of the nation, there are places where recovery is slower and where jobs have left and the jobs that have come back haven't been so good. So you could read Amy Goldstein's new book on Janesville, for instance. It's a nice description about what happened when the Chevy plant left and how people hung in there and as a community tried to pull themselves together, but they're not doing as well as they did before. Now, what I can tell you also, Fred, is that we're looking at the bottom end of the distribution. So the poverty line for a family of four in this report in Wisconsin is about $26,000. So you're talking about $2,100 or $2,200 a month for four people. So we don't get people who used to be making $60,000 that are now making $40,000. Or families where one person lost their job, so they went from a 200 family at 70 to a 100 family at 40 or 50. They don't make it into this report because they haven't fallen long enough. So there are a lot of people there who haven't recovered from where they were before the Great Recession, but at the very bottom of the barrel, we're at least starting to move in the right direction in most places in Wisconsin and in the country.
Well, Fred, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. And Tim, I want to talk a bit about social safety net programs.
Mm-hmm.
We have here in Wisconsin a proposal in the legislature going forward to drug test, for instance, recipients of welfare. How do you expect something like that to affect poverty rates?
Well, the drug tests aren't going to do very well. At least they never have in the past. Other states have tried drug tests that have found very little drug dependence. And even if you drug test and find someone who's got a drug problem, what do you do then? Do you cut them off of benefits, or do you try to get them into a rehab program, you know, under Badger Care, which is the right thing to do to try and help them cure their illness and get away from, you know, their opioid or whatever it is that's bothering them? More concern are the plans to work test virtually every program, the work test, the Badger Care program, to enhance more work tests in the food share program and in public housing.
And this is the move to get able-bodied adults to be looking for a job, actively seeking a job or in a job.
We already have some evidence on the ABOD efforts. In the middle of 2015, we tried that. And some of those people who failed the test and didn't do so well are, and I'm sure, are in our poverty numbers this year. But about 60,000 people who are able-bodied adults without dependents were told that either you have to work for your food stamps at least 20 hours a week, go find a job, or in 60 days we're going to cut you off. And 20,000 found a job, and that was good, but 40,000 couldn't find a job and were cut off. Now, I've done other work that tells me that about half of these people who were cut off were likely young men, mainly minority men, who were recently released from prison and who couldn't find a job because no one would hire them. So I work with a number of conservatives in the American Enterprise Institute, one being Mike Strain, who edited a book and who worked on a report on how to create more opportunity and better jobs in America. And in that report, the suggestion was that there should be a job of last resort. If you want to force someone to take a job and they can't find it, offer them a job. Offer them a job that pays $10 or $15 an hour, $10 an hour would even be enough above our $7.25 minimum wage, which is another problem. But offer them a job at that wage, and if they don't take the job, then okay, you do away with their benefits. But the idea is to find you might have to subsidize the private sector and nonprofits to hire some people where there are no jobs if you want to force them to work. So you're going to have to pay to help them get up and get out and get a job if there's no job available. And that's just the way it should be. Forcing people who've been released from prison who can't find jobs and have no countable income from earnings to say, well, we're not going to feed you then, you shouldn't get food stamps or food share, I think that's cruel. I don't think that's the right thing to do.
I want to go back to our callers now. We've got Marlon joining us next. He's in Madison. Marlon, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
My comment was about my experiences when I returned to Wisconsin after spending 4 years in the Army. I came back to Milwaukee in 1990. I'm now a special education teacher. I've been a teacher for 22 years. But I remember how hard it was finding a job. It didn't matter. I'm from the north side of Milwaukee, and it didn't matter that, you know, I graduated from a high school in Milwaukee. I had a college degree from Carroll College. Now it's Carroll University. There were still redlining practices. I wasn't aware at first that I was being redlined by my landline telephone number. So the first three numbers of my telephone number gave me a locator. I gave employers a locator. And then a friend of mine's dad, who worked for the Wisconsin prison system, taught me about redlining, how to get around it. I actually used his address for a while to find my first job when I came back to Wisconsin. And then he said, well, you can have people call me, and then I'll get in touch with you. And so I had to do that. And that got me my first job. But before that, he said the questions that he was being asked, and this is a white gentleman, he said the questions that he was being asked, like about me being black, were all questions about me being a suspect. Now, we have smartphones now, so you can't really redline in that manner, but I'm still concerned that there are still redlining practices in Milwaukee, whether you have a high school degree, a diploma, college degree, or not. If you're from the north side of Milwaukee, it's really hard to get out and find employment.
Marlon, thank you so much for bringing that up. I appreciate that. And Tim, do you see that as a factor of effects of systemic racism in housing practices going back decades and decades still being a factor?
Well, thank you, Marlon. That's a great story. And it fits with lots of things that we know about the labor market. It fits with, you call it redlining. We've done audit studies where you've given exactly, in other words, you've given an employer, let's say, an online resume for two different people, one with an obvious, a more obviously minority first name, be it black or Latino, and the other with a more obviously white Anglo first name or last name. And the differences in the callbacks are phenomenal. They're huge. So there is still discrimination there. There certainly is. And people have their preconceived notions about place and about race, and those enter into the decisions that are made. So we really have to make strong efforts to help people. I wrote a paper about how important it was to reemploy formerly incarcerated men. I must say, Marwin, I'll tell you this, that first in line should be veterans who are coming back who served our country. They should be in the front of the line, not pushed to the back of the line in terms of getting jobs. Right now, though, I mean, this is as good as the economy gets in most of the state and in most of the nation. It's not that good in Milwaukee. We need to go out and do a much better job in helping people locate work and keep work. And there's no better time to do it. But it takes an effort. It takes more than just coordination. It takes carrots, not just sticks. I also will say that it probably, and it does, take a little bit higher minimum wage. Our minimum wage of $7.25 is the federal minimum. 29 states and cities have higher minimum wages. The Congressional Budget Office tells us that if we had a minimum wage of $10 an hour, every 1 in 20 people who are working would lose a job, but the other 19 would get a raise. I'm willing to take that trade-off. In this strong economy, if in Wisconsin employers are really looking hard to find workers, well, we've got workers. Let's connect them. Let's let those employers talk about the sorts of workers that they need. Let's give them people who can work for them and tell them, hire these people. Give them an apprenticeship. Give them a job. In other words, the labor market could work a lot better than it is now, and there could be a lot less discrimination on all sorts of grounds. But we have to work at it. We have to actively work at it.
Well, Marlon, thank you so much. I appreciate that call.
That was great.
And
thank you.
Tim, as we wrap up, got about a little less than a minute left. You're a policymaker, a lawmaker, looking at this report. What are the takeaways, and what plans should be formed for the future?
Well, the takeaways are we're doing fine right now. You have to keep these programs, though, that work and keep them in place. And if the economy comes off its wheels again, or for people who can't find work, we really need the food assistance program, food share program, and we need refundable tax credits to help those with low earnings and those who have a real hard time finding work keep their heads above water and feed themselves. That's what any humane nation should do, any humane state and body should do. These are not hammocks that we're talking about. These are ways to help people who are down on their luck get a chance to rise up and join the middle class.
We leave it there. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was very nice being with you today.
That's Tim Smeeden, co-author of the most recent Wisconsin Poverty Report. He is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. And you can let us know what you think, your experience, your home, your personal economy, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Just when you thought it was safe to go in the backyard, the blood-sucking menace returns. Over the last week or so, I've noticed a big jump in the number of mosquitoes waiting for me when I step outside to do some weeding or take out the compost.
Smithsonian Magazine just reposted a timely article on that topic called "Why Do Mosquitoes Bite Some People More Than Others?" And it turns out that if you feel like mosquitoes target you, you might be right. About 20% of people are especially tasty to mosquitoes.
And there's a few different reasons. There's research out there. One, you can't do much about this. Blood type. Type O, mosquitoes land on about twice as much as they land on type A. Type B is somewhere in the middle there.
And another, we got to breathe, right? Well, you exhale carbon dioxide and, you know, it's hotter outside, you're warmer and sweatier. Exercise causes
Avoid
the mosquitoes
exercise.
To swarm. So, right, the takeaway here is clearly do not exercise.
Don't exercise. And here's a bad one for Wisconsin. There's just one study on this, so this is not locked in. But supposedly, according to the study, 1 12-ounce beer makes mosquitoes like us more, so that beer can be supposedly a mosquito attractant. Are you a big target for mosquitoes?
I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I don't feel like they get me too much, but they get me enough.
They go for my family members more than they go for me, so if I'm out with them, I'm in the clear. They all go to the other people.
Well, I'd wish us a mosquito-free summer, but that's not going to happen. And the bats got to eat, too.
True. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.